Hey listeners, can you believe it's June? Time certainly has a way of flying even in the midst of quarantine. It has made me realize that we are more adaptable and resilient than we give ourselves credit for. A lot has unfolded in the past 2 months, and whether we want to admit or not, we are changing with the season. For example, I have been doing a lot of evening walks since I can't go to the gym anymore to clear my head and to be outside. Honestly, from one day to the next, the path that I typically take doesn't seem to change a whole lot. But if I think back to any March evening when the air was more crisp and cool, I am reminded that nature and the world is changing with us. I'm sure many of you have read about the positive effects of lockdown on pollution and carbon emission. I honestly find the news both humiliating and humbling, if that makes any sense, as the news demonstrates how damaging our footprint has been on the environment. But it also shows us how little sacrifices and lifestyle changes can basically make an impactful, reversing difference. Today on Immigrantly, we welcome a very special guest who is all about the environment and fighting for Mother Earth as our home. Gilare Darabi is an environmental correspondent for the National Geographic Channel and Al Jazeera.
I'm Gilare Darabi in eastern Georgia, and I'm here in the country's capital, in the once sleepy fishing town of Donsal.
You found me!
The Sahara Desert covers nearly 10% of the African continent.
I've heard this is the biggest science project in the world. Is that true?
Physicists joke that nuclear fusion is the power source of the future.
I don't know what's going on, but all the boats are all racing towards one location.
Some of Haiti's poorer communities, the lack of an adequate sewage system is causing huge environmental problems.
It's hard to think of this dog as a tough detective who hunts down poachers. She's a big softy.
Voilà, c'est bien? Oui. There we go, my contribution. And I can see a Senegalese here, part of the Great Green Wall. Maybe I'll come back and watch it grow.
She grew up with lakes, forests, islands as her playground and now fights for their health and existence. She's an activist, a journalist, a filmmaker. Yet what I see as most core to her identity is her familial connection to this planet. I am so inspired by Gilare's passion and the way it drives her work. I hope for those listening that Gilare's story and this conversation draws you to your feet and that you feel a newfound appreciation for our earth. This is Immigrantly, and I'm your host, Sadia Khan.
Once I started sort of personifying the planet and seeing it as a mother figure, a grandmother, a generous, you know, being that keeps me alive, that gives me shelter, that gives me food. Once I started personifying her and building an inner dialogue with her, that's really when things shifted for me and I had a huge awakening.
Thank you so much for coming on my show. I am so excited to have you on my pod.
I'm so thrilled to be here.
So before we jump into things, I want to make sure that we get your name right. Could you just say it so that I hear it from you? Because I feel like it resonates more when you share your own name.
So my name is Gilare. The Iranian pronunciation, or Kurdish or Persian pronunciation, is Gelare, and that's what my parents would call me. But my whole life, ever since my family immigrated to Canada, I've been called Gilare by my friends and teachers. And that sort of pronunciation of the name has the best vibration for me. That's how I like to be called. So it's Gilare.
Oh, that's interesting, because I recorded an intro for this episode and I was looking at different pronunciations of the name, and obviously I was searching up Farsi names, and I came across the pronunciation that your parents use to call your name. So it's interesting how I kept on thinking it should be Gilare because I speak Pashto and Urdu at home. So the name sounds familiar, although I've never heard of it before, but it's the same dialect, I would say.
No, definitely I want to hear. And I loved how you pronounced it because that's so much like as if a family member was saying my name. It's a Kurdish name. It means the center of the eye. And it's in kind of like interpretive dance. I feel like my name is open to interpretation and my relationship with people, no matter how close or far we are from each other, everybody has a different way of saying my name or calling me a nickname. And I think that's a reflection of the relationship I hold with that person.
It makes so much sense because my kids have very ethnic names, both of them. I have two daughters and one of them is called Palvasha. And we pronounce it as Palvasha, but the name has metamorphosed and it has evolved into so many different interpretations of the same name. Her friends call her Palvasha, which sometimes annoys me because that's not the name that was meant for her. But then I think about it from her perspective, and I think she feels comfortable, and that's where we've left it at, like whichever pronunciation she's comfortable with. But as you pointed out, we have one pronunciation that's for family and friends, like close friends, family, and then there's another pronunciation for people who don't know Palvasha as well, or maybe her friends who don't know how to pronounce Palvasha.
I can totally relate to your daughter. I used to be so annoyed at, you know, why did my mom have to give me the most complicated name? And the spelling actually often makes people feel like it's Gaelic or Irish. So that's even more confusing. But in a sense, I've kind of seen it now as an invitation to play and an invitation to collaborate and personalize. And it's got this sort of like playful nature to it. My parents now call me Gel or Gallery or, you know, G, like they're kind of adapting to how my name is transmuting as well. So that's been really interesting. It's not stuck in the past. It's evolving. But no matter who calls me what version of it, that kind of is a representation of my relationship with them.
That makes so much sense. So let's talk about your childhood and what particular experiences nurtured your interest and now career in environmental science. I should tell you this, I am not big on environment and your projects are so compelling. So what nurtured that interest?
Oh, that's so incredibly sweet. Thank you. You know, it really comes down to my mother. I mean, I was born in Iran, but I was born into chaos. You know, the revolution was happening in Iran. My father was a captain in the Shah's Navy on his way to becoming an admiral. And when the revolution happened, our lives were turned upside down. So, you know, we packed up when I was 5 months old and sort of, in a way, fled the country. And we were, you know, stuck in Greece and trying to find a future, you know, having a young baby. My parents really didn't know which way to go. My dad thought perhaps we could go to Wales because he'd been accepted to the University of Cardiff, but plans with visa papers didn't come through because of our Iranian identity, and Canada opened its doors up to us. Really, my parents had no intention of moving to Canada, but through luck and through chance, Canada opened its doors up to us, and we landed in Vancouver when I was about 2 years old. In the in-between time, we were in Athens in Greece. So interesting, you know, the migrant crisis that we see and the story of refugees and the stories of asylum seekers. Greece plays such an interesting part of that journey. You know, that was a part of my journey as an immigrant as well. And Vancouver, British Columbia, opened up its arms to my family. And it's no lie when they say it is the most beautiful place on earth. It's also the birthplace of Greenpeace, birthplace of great activism. The nature is just all-encompassing and so beautiful. I feel incredibly lucky to have grown up there. And, you know, a big part of my childhood was a walk with the family. My mom is an activist at her heart, is very connected spiritually to nature. And our walks were just sort of these magical experiences where we were really in relation with the nature around us and the storytelling that would emerge from my mother as we were walking on these paths and trails was the seed that was planted within me.
And you travel a lot for your work, right? Where has your work brought you? Can you share some of the places that you traveled and maybe a crazy story where you found yourself just in complete awe of the landscape you were filming or even like the animals that you encountered?
Well, you know, after I covered the bushfires in Australia this past year, in January, I can now say that I've reported from 6 continents, you know, and so that's pretty amazing. I've been all over from China to the Democratic Republic of Congo, to the Philippines, to Haiti, Afghanistan, Senegal, Iran, Brazil, to the Amazon rainforest. Gosh, what a gift that was. What an amazing journey. I've reported from Canada, all over the world. It's been incredible, but absolutely going to the Amazon rainforest back in July was incredibly eye-opening and a bit challenging, you know, to be immersed in such a wild landscape. We were about to interview a top scientist and expert in the Amazon who had spent his entire career reporting from that region. And we were trying to find the best place to interview him. And he's like, oh, you know, there's a really nice pathway. Why don't we head down here? I think this is a nice spot. And it was strange because something inside of me was telling me that we were going to see a snake. I just knew it. And I was sort of asking him, like, have you seen any, you know, interesting animals working in this region along the way? And he was telling me different stories, but it was the story of the snake that he told me that suddenly triggered my intuition to know that we were going to encounter a snake. And I would say maybe a minute after that sort of download was passed on to me, we encountered the most venomous snake in the region. It's called the Bushmaster. In the native language, in Portuguese, I think they call it surujucu. And it was one of the most terrifying experiences of my life. The snake made it very clear to us that it did not want us there. It kind of rippled through all the leaves and all the sort of debris on the forest floor. And the snake is known for chasing after people and jumping. So if you're going to get a bite from the snake, it normally will bite you sort of on the chest or the face because it can jump really high. In this case, the snake decided not to do that and to just give us a very stern warning. But apparently, if you are bitten by the snake, you only have hours to live. If they don't get you to hospital right away, that's it. And so that was, you know, I've never really felt the hairs on the back of my neck really stand up. I've always thought that's an interesting expression, but that was the first time I really felt them stand up. And I was quite shocked for the rest of the day.
So, Guilherme, you've traveled so much. And as you said, you've had encounters probably with all sorts of animals. Is there a particular animal that you're really scared of?
Not really. I used to be a total arachnophobe and terrified of bugs. But then when I traveled to DRC, to the Congo, I was staying in a really like pleasant and lovely space that was just occupied by bugs. And I kind of had like a chat with myself, like a mental conversation where it was like, listen, are you going to stay up all night and worry and not have this experience of a lifetime because you're worried about bugs? I kind of talked myself out of that fear. There was literally like a praying mantis, like rubbing its hands on my pillow. There was nothing I could do. The whole place was just so alive with those roly-poly millipedes and all kinds of spiders. And that chat, that mental chat that I had with myself that day, I haven't gone back. From that moment forward, I'm not afraid of bugs at all. In fact, I'm quite interested in them. So at this point, I would say no, there's no animal that scares me. But that snake, you know, certainly sent me a strong message that keep your distance. You know, that's really important. And I think in this world right now and all the challenges we're facing, that message of keep your distance is very important.
So let's talk about the countries that you've been to. As you mentioned, you've been to Iran, you've been to Afghanistan, you've been to DRC. Now, when I think about these countries, unfortunately, in the West, these countries are in a way demonized, right? And there are these misconceptions that are held. What are some of the misconceptions about the environment with respect to, say, Afghanistan and Iran that you commonly come across and that bother you?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, the landscapes are absolutely stunning. I mean, when I traveled to the Banda Amir National Park in Afghanistan, I, to this day, have never seen land so beautiful. The beautiful blue mineral lakes, the huge mountains and landscape, and the people, most importantly, are the most beautiful. You know, myself, having been born in Iran and coming from a country that has a lot of misconceptions and sort of, you know, very negative narratives tied around it, I've had to kind of explain myself a lot in life. So I don't step onto any land with those kind of misconceptions. I really try to go in a clear slate and I find stories that really offer a lot of hope. You know, in my research and digging and the initial phase and what story do I want to tell, it often comes from a very pure, innocent, kind of curious place. In Afghanistan, I just found a small article about these four female rangers that the national park had hired. I couldn't believe it. In Afghanistan, really? They're hiring females rangers. And that sort of curiosity, of course, it came from a narrative of, well, I didn't think women could work in Afghanistan. Can they work there? I didn't think women could be park rangers in Afghanistan. Can they? It did come from what the Western media was telling me, but I took it a little bit deeper and just sort of went in with a clear slate and like, well, tell me what's really going on here. And the story was just, you know, the park was receiving so many visitors and a lot of those visitors were women and children. So they were in a jam. You know, the male rangers couldn't go and tell the women and children how to behave and what to do. So they had to hire female rangers. It came out of a necessity, even though it kind of broke many cultural norms. And the opportunity that it gave those women, the confidence, that was really, truly groundbreaking.
So how are those countries and regions responding to the climate crisis? And what can we in the West learn from them?
I mean, often these countries are facing security issues that are so incredibly severe, sanctions, survival issues. So climate change and environmental issues are not at the top of their list. But when the water runs out, as it did in many parts of Iran, it becomes a top security issue. I think there's an awakening that's happening that environmental issues are a top security issue, and that if you have access to clean water, if you have clean air, you are safe, just as a thriving economy would keep you safe. So those awakenings are starting to happen. Unfortunately, they're coming, you know, when the streams and rivers dry up, when the crops are not turning up and offering, you know, the work and the abundance that they need to. But there is an important conversation that is starting to happen in countries that face incredible security issues.
So it's basically linked to the security of those countries, and that's how they are trying to prioritize it now?
Absolutely. Like, you know, in Iran, environmental discourse wasn't really that prominent until the water crisis, you know, the drought, the lack of water. So many people in that country are farmers. And when they could no longer water their crops, could no longer grow food, sell food, feed their families, they really understood that, you know, environmental protection, environmental security is human security. You know, it's a safeguarding that happens on so many levels.
Kirare, when we talk about environment and climate crisis, how cognizant are Western countries in terms of the repercussions of it or the impact it can have? Because we hear a lot of rhetoric, but I am not sure how much is happening on the ground, even in the US.
I mean, what's really inspiring is what's happening on grassroots community levels, you know, on smaller scale organizations coming together of people, that's where there's real action and real important discourse happening. When you sort of magnify that and take it to sort of different government levels and different sort of international conversations that are happening, that's where I feel a lot of us are sensing that disappointment. In a way, you have to get micro to find the hope when it comes to understanding climate change and doing something about it. And I think it's that patchwork of micro movements and simple acts and community initiatives that are coming together that are really building a stronger quilt across this whole world. The conversations, you know, all being interconnected on the internet and in so many different ways on social media. Those conversations are really what are creating the patchwork of hope. I've taken sort of my interest out of, you know, the big UN climate conferences and then the big talks, you know, because I often feel such a sense of letdown and disappointment afterwards. But when I turn around and just walk around my neighborhood and chat with my neighbors and look in people's backyards, that's where I see the greatest activism taking place.
So why do you think that's happening in the UN? Is it bureaucracy that's causing it?
You know, every country, of course, has their own interests, and it's so easy to sort of pass on the buck of responsibility. And when you have this sort of large scale coming together, you can kind of pass that responsibility around a lot faster. There isn't really any initiative because an economy has always been seen as so different and so separate from climate. And one thing that, you know, COVID-19 and this pandemic has taught us is that, in fact, the two are so interrelated. I'd be interested in what kind of conversations come out of these UN conferences post-COVID-19. There's a huge environmental awakening that wasn't planned and wasn't expected that has come out of this incredibly unfortunate pandemic.
So let's factor in COVID-19 and shutdowns due to this pandemic, which is, and I quote, giving the planet a break from some of our most destructive industries and lifestyles. I pulled this from a report that you gave for Al Jazeera about the improvement of air quality due to global quarantine measures. Now, when sometimes I think about this global outbreak, which has become a crisis, I honestly cannot help but wonder if somehow Mother Nature is teaching us a lesson, you know, a reckoning almost. But then I also check myself and I'm like, who am I to judge what's happening and why it's happening, right? So as we plan for future, and if I were to ask you to help us define recovery with climate action in mind, how do you think we should balance restarting the economy, ensuring people's lives and livelihoods are safe, and also keeping in mind workers?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, the Mother Nature sort of analogy that she's teaching us a lesson. I've thought about that many times as well. There is a sort of a great karma, a great lesson, a great warning that has been coming for a long time from scientists, academics, people who work closely with the land, farmers, that finally has kind of come in the most devastating way. So I do think that there's an interesting bit of truth to that analogy. You know, before I go around telling people what to do and pointing any fingers, I like to take a look at myself. I like to look in the mirror. Let's look at how my life has changed. You know, as you have mentioned, I'm an international correspondent. I've traveled to 6 continents. I visited all 4 corners of this beautiful planet, reporting on all different kinds of things. I've been under quarantine like everybody else. I've got camera equipment here. I've got a small lighting kit, a Zoom recorder like you. And I've been able to still continue my work with just my iPhone and, you know, a wonderful team of producers like before. My carbon footprint is much smaller. And interestingly enough, my films are having even more impact than the ones from the field. So perhaps there's something I could do to still be an effective environmental journalist, but not have to travel so much and not have to get on so many airplanes, trains, and cars to tell a story. Sometimes using stock images or using camera people from the land who can share images from their backyard with me, I'm able to tell just as compelling a story as when I was flying around the world. That's an interesting, eye-opening experience. That's really kind of something I'm sitting with at the moment.
That's such an interesting perspective. So basically, redefining our walk and how we approach walk.
Absolutely. I think a lot of major organizations as well are noticing that their employees are just as productive, maybe even more so, when they work from home. We don't need babysitters. We don't need someone looking over our shoulder. Yes, it's nice to come together as a team of colleagues, but listen, we can still get the job done and we can still keep things going sitting in our sweatpants at home. You know, the only thing I think that's really changed in that atmosphere is the work attire. But we're getting it done. And we're actually, in my case, you know, having huge impact. And I would have never thought that. I thought when COVID-19 hit that my career as a Correspondent was on hold for a long time, and I'm busier now more than ever with a simple technical kit and my voice and my knowledge. It's coming across stronger than ever.
Clary, how do you respond to people and maybe push back against the notion that environmental rights are second to human rights? I'm sure you've heard this somewhere by someone.
It's always sort of pushed to the back burner. I think a lot of people recognize that environmental discourse needs to happen, but not now because, you know, the economy, or not now because of war, or not now because of the migrant crisis. The interesting thing that I think is awakening a lot of people is the root cause of a lot of these conflicts, great migrations, economic instability is an environmental issue. They're usually at the root cause is something within our planet that is imbalanced and that is causing great uncertainty for humans. Climate refugees are, you know, that's a real thing. You know, people who can no longer farm and grow food and sell food, that's a very real thing because of lack of water. It creates so much instability in people's lives. That balance, I think, needs to be recognized, that environmental respect and giving it its due in terms of, you know, international discourse could bring a lot of stability and balance to a lot of uncertainty at such a fragile time in human history.
Do you think it's also because climate crisis impacts communities that don't have the kind of power to effect change? Because when I look at developed countries, I'm assuming they are probably going to be the last ones to face the, you know, jarring effects of, say, climate change. And by then, maybe damage will be irreversible, but they are not taking action. And do you think COVID-19 has somehow changed that perspective?
A couple points come to mind here. I think, you know, it impacts us all, you know, from the California wildfires to the Amazon, to Brazil, to the wildfires in British Columbia and different parts of Canada, you know, to locusts taking over entire continents. Like, it's inescapable at this point. The interesting thing is some of the best innovation and best ideas I've seen come out to sort of offer a solution have been coming out of the developing world and even out of refugee camps. So I feel like the innovation and the ideas and the initiative are emerging from very unexpected places, because it is at the forefront of their dialogue and it's at the forefront of their daily life.
Because of the magnitude of impact?
Sure, because of the magnitude of impact and because of displacement. You know, when you've had to leave your native land because you can no longer farm there, you can no longer live there, the temperatures are just absolutely unbearable, you sit in a place of thinking, of deep thinking and innovating. How can I return home? How can I create a new home? And how can I make sure this doesn't happen to anybody else again?
So, Clary, I wanted to get your thoughts on the Green New Deal. Now, some people think it's unrealistic and even radical, which I don't agree with. But what do you think?
Before COVID-19, I thought it wasn't very realistic. And I thought it really was a little bit of a Band-Aid solution. There was so much hope placed on electric cars and, you know, electric trains. And you know, when I did a little bit of digging, you know, the batteries and the environmental costs of these sort of new initiatives put forward were sort of just as damaging and just as worrying. But after COVID-19, I have a different perspective. I think something that really gives workers who work in a fossil fuel-based industry a chance to retrain and to innovate and to move forward is actually really what we need right now. The economy and climate are not separate, and what people need right now are jobs and opportunity. And if we can really build a green infrastructure and give people a chance to kind of have a whole new career in this really exciting, forward-thinking sector, that is, you know, what most people need right now. They need to earn a living. They need to get back to work. And there's so much opportunity here.
Clary, I want to switch gears. And before we end this interview, I want to ask you about something that I was watching, another project that you did. And it really caught my eye. You went to this survivalist community in South Dakota, right?
That's right.
About 18 square miles. We're prepared here for everything, from tsunamis to asteroids to economic collapse to everything. The key here is it's a community. When it's fully built out, this will accommodate 10,000 people. The event is one thing, but surviving the aftermath is another. And when they come out, maybe it's a week later, maybe it's a month, maybe it's a year. But they can have enough provision in there for up to 24 people for a year.
Wow, that is not what I was expecting.
Behold.
This is like a condo in Miami.
You're not gonna wanna go out. You're gonna say, you know, let me know how it is out there. I don't need to go, I'm very comfortable in here.
Except the whole world could be falling apart outside.
That's a piece I did for National Geographic, their Explorer series. And we were sort of looking at the time we were looking at the threat of nuclear attack from North Korea and what Americans were doing to sort of find protection, you know, protect their families and create a sense of security. They were investing in these sort of doomsday bunkers, you know, these abandoned concrete structures that used to hold missiles in them during the world wars, and they were taking over them and sort of renovating them to look like these fancy condos, but really, you know, they were just there to help them feel safe should there be any kind of attack or any instability in their country. And these nuclear bunkers, these doomsday bunkers, were going for a pretty hefty price. It's interesting because I got to meet some lovely people, some everyday charming, kind American families who had recently bought one of those bunkers. And I got to go shopping with them as they picked out paint colors for the ceilings and the walls and talked about how they wanted to decorate it. And they were just some of the loveliest people. I've been thinking a lot about them during COVID-19. I'm wondering if they're all hanging out in their bunkers right now and feeling safe. It's such an uncertain time in this world. Has this investment brought them any kind of solace and any kind of feeling of safeness? They've been on my mind recently, so it's funny you should bring them up.
So what I was struggling with as I was watching it is, to me, it seemed a bit selfish in a way. It's not right to judge someone, but I was thinking, okay, if somebody is sitting inside their bunkers while the world is falling apart, does that even happen? Like, how do you stop yourself from going out and helping somebody or opening your door for people who are outside? Like, I kept on thinking about that, and I couldn't really reconcile with the idea. And now that COVID-19 is happening, how many times do we help or think about others? You know, it's just, this was just like this one introspective moment that I had when I was watching that video and comparing it to what's happening right now.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was interviewing that family, that was definitely something in the back of my mind. It went against the idea, the notion I had of Americans. You know, anytime there's been a major crisis, a major disaster, I'd always known Americans to be some of the most helpful, selfless, you know, generous people in times of crisis. But certainly, we're all proving in many ways that we can be just as generous, helpful, and selfless in times of COVID. You know, there are, again, micro stories of communities coming together and lending a hand, neighbors helping each other, that are incredibly heartwarming. I think it's understandable that people are afraid and they want to hunker down, and then there isn't a lot of trust, especially trust of the other. That's why I think it's so important that storytelling like what you're doing right now and what I'm trying to do is so important, to really show that the other is not a scary thing and that we really share so much. We are all worried about our families. We're all worried about our elders. We're all worried about ourselves. That's kind of, you know, what we're doing right now may seem so simple, and I don't know if anybody's listening or if anybody's watching, but it has such a major chance to bring people together right now.
That's true. So in the end, what does a livable green planet mean to you? And what does that look like for America?
It's interesting the reference that you made to Mother Nature, because it was really through my mom and through living in British Columbia that I really established a strong relationship with Mother Nature. Once I started sort of personifying the planet and seeing it as a mother figure, a grandmother, a generous, you know, being that keeps me alive, that gives me shelter, that gives me food. Once I started personifying her and building an inner dialogue with her, that's really when things shifted for me and I had a huge awakening. And that's sort of what's made me such a ferocious activist, because when something happens to her, I feel like a family member is being hurt, you know? I feel like a family member is sick. I think that we really need to stop seeing ourselves as separate from the natural world. And I think where that starts is how we raise our children. It's the little ones. You know, environmental education is so important. Environmental programming, I was so fortunate to have that growing up in Canada. Really like creating this narrative that we are one with the natural world around us. And I'm not saying it's too late for us adults, but really we need to pay attention to how we talk to our children about the environment and how we allow them to experience the environment. In my film in China, we were looking at how bad the pollution was, that so many children, an entire generation of children, are growing up indoors. This is way before COVID-19. You know, we're all having that reality now. But it's important for us to get back outside, to make sure that we do it safely and in a way of balance and in a way that respects her, Mother Nature, you know, the home planet that has been such a beautiful host to all of us.
Could you share some changes we can make in our day-to-day lives to help the environment? Just a few changes.
I think it's really important to speak up and to get political and to read up on what's happening. You know, during COVID-19, as everybody's been worried about their jobs, worried about security, and worried about getting sick, a lot of important environmental regulations are being sort of, you know, taken off the map, being erased, for the sake of rebooting the economy. It's important to keep your nose in the newspapers, to keep your nose in what's happening politically, to tweet, to shout out, to tell your friends. You know, it's so easy to ostrich right now, to bury your head. The world is so overwhelming. I get it. But it's our duty to bear witness. It's our duty to know what's going on and to say something about it. You know, really use your voice. And every time you pay for something, every time you pull out your wallet, you are voting. Who do you want to give your money to? You know, do some research. How are they treating the planet? How are they treating other humans? That's been a really important part of my daily practice.
That's such a good point. And for that, we have to have a critical mass of consumers who should be doing this on a regular basis, right?
Absolutely. And you know, it can be fun. It doesn't have to always be so serious. Like, for example, I'm greening my wardrobe right now. So I'm completely changing my wardrobe and doing some deep research, working with some really fun creative people in making sure that the clothing that I wear and the things I put on my body have a story and a background and an initiative and ethics behind them that I feel comfortable with. And I've been learning so much and it's been an absolute blast. And when I put on clothing now, I feel so proud. I feel so confident because I know the journey of that piece of clothing and I'm okay with it. I feel at peace with it. So it doesn't have to always be so serious. A lot of people through COVID-19 have been planting gardens, growing their own food. I'm seeing a lot of bread out there. People are making a lot of bread. And it's just so beautiful. It doesn't always have to come from a place of fear and seriousness. We can have fun with this.
But do you think it's also expensive to do that? And not everybody can afford to invest in clothing like that or go to farmers market, because at the end of the day, all of that is expensive.
It's interesting because I'm spending less than I ever have on clothing. I used to be the kind of person that would just buy everything. Oh, it's on sale. Oh, great H&M. You buy, you know, you pay for one, you get five. This sounds like a bargain. But, you know, bits of clothing never lasted. They never sort of satisfied that emptiness inside of me that was just trying to fill something up. What I've been working on is a micro closet right now. I like literally, if you walk into my closet, there are not that many pieces, but I have invested in pieces that I know are going to last a long time, that I'm going to get a lot of wear out, not just throw them in the wash and then have them fall apart. Sometimes when you feel like you're getting a deal, you're not really. That's something I've realized. I'm investing in pieces that I know are going to last me a while. I'm also investing in, you know, knowing how to darn and sew and fix things so that if they do, you know, get a little bit of wear and tear, that I can kind of keep them going. I'm also, you know, I'm starting to buy a lot of vintage again and use clothing and working with some amazing vintage collectors in Los Angeles who are sort of, you know, suggesting pieces to me that kind of complete this micro wardrobe. For me, it's less about spending money and it's more about the experience and the few things that I truly cherish, as opposed to the hundreds of pieces that kind of give me the illusion of having plenty when really I can't really satisfy a need inside.
That's wonderful. And can you share those vendors with us, the names? Maybe we can post it on our website and see if we can get more people to try those clothes out.
I would love to. And you know, COVID-19 has been devastating for these shops, and they've been innovating. They've been using their Instagram stories and their Instagram to get the vintage out and to create little mini sales. And they're finding ways to adapt. And I think that's a bit of inspiration to us all, that we can all find ways to adapt that are much more mindful and respectful of the planet.
And Guillory, in the end, if people wanted to look for your work, do you have a Twitter, IG, your website that you can share with us?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter and IG. It's all under my name, Guillory Darabi. Good luck with the spelling and good luck with the pronunciation, and whatever version of my name that you want to call me and whatever sounds right to you. I acknowledge your interpretation, and I think it's really creative and I think it's really cool.
Great. This was wonderful. Thank you so much for coming on my pod. I had so much fun talking to you.
Same here. And thanks for creating opportunity and giving voice to, you know, all different kinds of people and accents and names, you know, that sometimes get ignored because it's like, well, I can't call her. I can't pronounce that. Yeah. You step into the ring and you do it gracefully. And it's awesome. Thank you for creating space.
Thank you so much for listening to Guillory's episode. I hope we can all do some introspection and see how we are hurting Mother Earth and maybe make some lifestyle changes that will have long-lasting impact. Guys, I will be posting all information about Guillory's work on our website, our social media platforms. For more information about Immigrantly, you can check our website, immigrantlypod.com. We have a Patreon and GoFundMe. If you haven't donated yet, I hope you consider doing that, because that's how we sustain our podcast. Until next time, when we will bring another incredible story, and please stay safe and distant.